Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Everyone, welcome to the special episode, this bonus edition of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I'm glad to be bringing you this conversation that I had just the other day with Kristen Cobes-Dumais. She is the author of the book that's just come out a little while ago called Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. And she was a guest not long ago on the show where we discussed her book. That was a fantastic interview. If you haven't caught that, go back and listen to it for sure. Also, you can catch her on our last month's Mindshift podcast Zoom call that we do every month. That is available on the Mindshift podcast Facebook page. This is something that is available only to those who support this show on Patreon. And in fact, speaking of Zoom calls, as I'm now recording this introduction, it is Sunday the 30th of August. Later on tonight, we are going to have a special bonus Zoom call with my good friends Conway and Siegelman. They are, of course, the authors of the fantastic books Snapping and Holy Terror. They're doing a project with ex-evangelicals, so I'm super excited to host that call along with Conway and Siegelman tonight. So that will eventually be available also on the Mindshift Podcast Facebook page at some point, but great benefit for being a supporter of this show. Now, speaking of Kristen Cobes-Dumais, the reason I wanted to talk to her in particular was because, of course, the unfolding scandals around Jerry Falwell Jr. and his wife Becky Falwell, the sex abuse scandals that have kind of grabbed the nation's headlines. And I thought, what better person to talk about than Kristen, because of course her book is all about toxic evangelical masculinity and really the damaging legacy that it's caused. And Jerry Falwell and his wife, really, they're kind of case studies for this whole thing. So I hope you enjoy this chat, the special bonus edition with Kristen Cobes-Dumais, as we dissect, we take a deep dive into the scandals surrounding Jerry Falwell Jr., his wife Becky, and what ultimately brought him down as the president of Liberty University. I'm so happy to welcome back Kristen Cobes-Dumais, author of Jesus and John Wayne. Thank you so much, Kristen, for taking some time out of your super busy schedule to talk to me.
Oh, happy to be here.
Okay, I know we're all slammed. We're getting ready for students coming in next week, but I thought the other day, with all the stuff unfolding around Jerry Falwell Jr., Becky Falwell, you are the best person, I think, at this point to talk to you about this stuff. I needed to bounce some things off of you, really. That's why I wanted to talk to you, because I thought, okay, nobody else wants to talk about this stuff. I don't have any friends over here that are even interested. I said to a guy at work the other day, did you see the latest story on Jerry Falwell Jr.? And he said, who? They don't even know here in Britain who Falwell was, is.
Sounds lovely.
Now, I thought, okay, you're the perfect person to talk to, because your book, Jesus and John Wayne, to me, it kind of like it's two parallel tracks. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think you've got on one hand the sort of biblical patriarchy, the toxic evangelical masculinity that's done a lot of damage within evangelicalism to people and to churches and all that. Then the other track is that has really led to, in many ways, the evangelical support for Donald Trump. That's kind of the logical outcome of that system. Does that sound like a fair assessment of your book?
Yes. Yes.
Right. And I know we talked about that in our podcast before. So if people want to listen to that episode, we take a deep dive into your book.
Yes. Right?
So we were talking about your book is a really valuable resource for people who want to understand the sort of nature of evangelical masculinity and how that led to the support of Donald Trump in many ways by white evangelicals. But how does that relate to the Jerry Falwell story? Because obviously he plays a pivotal role. He was one of the first main evangelical leaders to support Trump as a candidate. How does it relate to what's happening now as you see it?
Oh, I mean, this is such a tangled story. And most obviously, I think just to start with the basics, Jerry Falwell Jr. was one of the earliest evangelical leaders to come out and endorse Donald Trump. And he did that at a time when, I want to clarify that, you know, one of the leaders, that there was also already significant grassroots support for Trump in evangelical circles. And, you know, already in 2015, in the late summer of 2015, we were starting to see this in survey data that only increased over the course of the fall of 2015. And then by early 2016, that's when we have Jerry Falwell Jr. and Robert Jeffress kind of formally declaring their support. With Jeffress, it wasn't a formal endorsement, but it essentially was because he's a pastor. And at that point, that kind of, in some ways, gave permission for other evangelicals to own their support for Trump. But I'm not sure that, it's hard to tell how significant that support was in changing anybody's minds. You know, I think it really kind of gave this permission to acknowledge what was already there. And that was in contrast to many of the more kind of respectable traditional evangelical leaders who were still quite skeptical about Trump. Many of them preferred other candidates, either Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio. And so Jeffress and Falwell were kind of the first prominent Trump supporters in the evangelical community. So that's part of the background. Now, Falwell had actually had connections to Trump going back years earlier. And this is something I write about in Jesus and John Wayne. In 2012, he had Trump speak at Liberty University. Mm-hmm. And now, very interestingly, if you're following the pool boy scandal, Giancarlo Granda was actually there at that 2012 speech.
Now, I didn't know that.
I think that was initially in my book. And then in the very, very last stages of legal review, we ended up taking some of that out. When I was asked who's most likely to see you over this book, he was one of the names that came up immediately. And so we ended up taking out some of the pool boy story, even though we already knew much of the information that is now public. So I'll get back to that. But back in 2012, Trump speaks at Liberty University, causes a little bit of controversy in the evangelical world because he is irreverent. He's crass. He's talking about, he tells students that they need to get even with people who, you know, in business. And so there's this discussion of, is this Christian? Are these Christian values? And Falwell comes out supporting him already in 2012 saying, this is tough Christianity. And right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his father was kind of a proponent of this tough Christianity, this culture wars Christianity. And so, so they go way back. Now, what we also know, and there were rumors a year ago that this was the case, already in 2012, that's when we have some of this potential blackmail taking place between Granda and Cohen, Trump's fixer, who was also there at 2012 Liberty. And so it's this tangled mess. And all of this was evident in 2019, last summer already, when the New York Times came out with this big story. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know exactly, you know, we had allegations. This was not fully litigated back then, particularly the role that any potential blackmail might have played. And sorry, I missed the fact that the blackmail was around photographs that existed of presumably Becky Falwell, and Granda was involved in this. Granda now has denied that he ever blackmailed them, but there were photographs. Cohen had a hand in taking care of this, and that's kind of this backstory. Mm-hmm. That we're dealing with. Now, for how to make sense of this all, I mean, there's so much drama here.
So tangled web, isn't it?
It is. And then we haven't even talked about Becky and her role.
We'll get to that, I'm sure.
Yeah. But I think the first thing that's important to realize is, you know, whether or not there was any pressure on Falwell to endorse Trump in 2016. Mm-hmm. And Cohen acknowledges that he asked Falwell to support Trump at that point in Iowa in particular to shore up support with evangelicals. He says he did it because of their longstanding friendship and not any quid pro quo. So that's important to state. In the book, I, again, in limited fashion, wrestled with this because I was already aware of some of these allegations and concluded at that time that, you know, there is no evidence of quid pro quo. I don't think there is yet still, but there were these deep affinities really between Falwell's embrace of this tough Christianity and the kind of leadership that Trump was already modeling and has long modeled. And I think that's one of the important things for us to keep in focus, that this is not just a, you know, a salacious story about the downfall of one, you know, hypocritical Christian leader, that we have to keep the broader context in mind of not only how Falwell Jr. came to hold his particular understanding of Christianity and power and sex and all these things, but how the broader community, evangelical community at Liberty, and conservative evangelicalism more broadly has also enabled what we see unfolding right now. Abuses of power, this seeming hypocrisy is actually deeply rooted in certain values within conservative evangelicalism.
One of the things that was so striking to me as the story started unfolding just a few weeks back, when that original article came out by Granda in Reuters, I think it was.
Yeah.
The Liberty board, you know, they took such a passive role, even to the point when it came, he resigned, then he took it back, then he took, you know, so I'm like, oh, wait, I've got a sweetheart deal here. He's going to resign with $10.5 million golden parachute. It's unbelievable. The ultimate slap in the face. And the way it worked out was Falwell walked away and he said, well, the board didn't say I did anything wrong, so therefore I'm eligible for all this money, this golden handshake or whatever you want to call it. And I'm thinking, at what point were they just going to fire him, for God's sake? And they never did.
Yeah.
They let them.
They didn't.
Yeah, they just let it. They let him be in control right to the very end. And I mean, obviously, there's so many. There were so many other scandals that went on: the blackface tweets and the shady real estate dealings and the personal trainer deal. And come on, where does it end? The board did nothing, said nothing.
Exactly, and that's why it's no surprise that the board did nothing, said nothing, and still gave him $10.5 million to walk out the door.
Really,
because this has been going on for years and years. And you know, really, talk to anybody at Liberty, anybody who's been a part of the Liberty community. We've seen this exodus of faculty members, of students, for years. Also, and you listed some of these, you know, scandals that have emerged in recent years, but again, when you talk to folks at Liberty, his behavior, his sexual impropriety, like these were open secret there. Mm-hmm. And when you know, as the details come out, you can see how, of course they had to have been. But the way that power was structured, I think there's a couple of things to realize about how power operated there. First of all, right, it was an authoritarian regime, essentially. He had absolute power, and he had the kind of charisma of the great leader. He was the heir to the Falwell legacy. All of that played in. So that's one way power operated, in a kind of coercive fashion. There's no tenure for faculty, so no academic freedom, all of that. But I think there's an even more pernicious sort of power that operated there. And that was that there were so many true believers who went to Liberty because of their Christian faith and of their conservative evangelical faith. And you see this in the allegations now of the former student who was accusing Becky Falwell of grooming him and assaulting him. Mm-hmm. This idea that, you know, they were participating in something great, being part of Liberty, and that they had such respect for Falwell and for the institution, that there was another kind of coercion that was going on. You know, none of the victims wanted to expose Falwell or the institution to the shame and critique that would come along with that. And that's really, in these faith communities, in cases of abusive power and sexual abuse, this is a pattern. It does so much damage to the victims, who think that they have to, you know, hide their own abuse and in a sense then perpetuate the abuse, because they don't want to damage the witness of Christ, the witness of the institution. And it's just tragic to see how that has played out at Liberty, as it has in many other conservative evangelical institutions.
It struck me too. I've been following the Falwell Jr. scandals for several years now as well. I'm sure you have too, and researching your book and everything else. what struck me was there's this dynamic at play that's eerily similar to the way the evangelical Trump supporter justifies their support for Trump. When Falwell Jr. took over the university, it was struggling. Financially, it was in deep trouble. He turned it around. I mean, you can't deny that he did not do a great job as far as that goes, economically getting the university. I mean, it's got 100,000 online students. It's got a $1.6 billion endowment. I mean, it's got incredible amount of money financially. It's in great shape. So therefore, he's done a great job economically, but yet there's been scandal after scandal. Well, you can turn a blind eye to that as long as, you know, there's the compartmentalization, you know. And I remember hearing David Barton talking about this on Kenneth Copeland's Believer's Voice of Victory. He said, look, I don't care for Trump's tweets and his, you know, some of the things he says and does, but he's putting America in a place where God can bless the nation. And so that's what we really need to focus on. And I'm thinking there's the same type of compartmentalized logic that, you know, justifies the Trump support.
Yeah, you have that compartmentalized logic. But then I would say, too, there are still some underlying affinities as well. So, you know, what kind of leader is needed in a moment such as this, right? You know, so so the very attributes that get Trump in trouble, that get Falwell in trouble, perhaps. So the Falwell, it's a little trickier here as we understand his role in this latest scandal. But, you know, generally speaking, the kind of attributes that are going to get men in trouble sometimes, testosterone-fueled men, are precisely those attributes that we need in a leader right now, right? We need the toughness, we need the recklessness, and we've got to take the whole package, right? We have to take what, you know, all of the bad things too, because this is how God made men, and this militancy is absolutely what we need in a leader. And these are precisely the men that we need to be leading us. So just, you know, drop the criticism. Are you better equipped to lead this institution, this university, this country? I don't think so. Right. And so there's a compartmentalizing, but there's also this idea of fundamental to their conception of their faith. It is very us versus them, kind of militant culture wars mentality, where you need this kind of militant warrior leader with all that entails. And there's going to be kind of sexual kind of side effects to this, impropriety from time to time. But come on, guys, this is the kind of leader we need.
If you're going to put a strong man in power, then, you know, is something that Lisa Simpson said on an episode of The Simpsons. She said, if you're going to create a monster, then don't be surprised if it knocks over a few buildings.
You know, exactly.
Really true. You take the good to the bad. Frankenstein's monster, isn't it?
Exactly. So one of the, you know, writers on masculinity that I, of the many that I quote, if you want a tamer leader, castrate him, right? You know, like if you're not happy with this, well, you know, you need a man with the balls to lead.
Literally. Well, the one thing that brought him down, the straw that broke the camel's back, was the Instagram photo, the racy photo on Instagram where he's got his arm around, I guess it was his wife's personal assistant, apparently, with the trousers unzipped and all the rest of it. What's weird, I don't know, did you hear anything like from the evangelical community, almost like, hey, that's cool. That's Falwell being a stud. I mean, what did you hear in response to that when it originally first came out?
I heard very little except for those who were really from the inside of Liberty in particular, who were critics. And then also from people who were already critics of Jerry Falwell. So I actually didn't hear much from conservative evangelicals who liked Falwell one way or the other. I just heard kind of silence from those corners. Maybe I missed it. Maybe I'm just not in touch with those particular communities. So I didn't hear anybody really actively defending him, although we barely had time to kind of let this kind of settle before things, you know, got even more complicated. So what I had anticipated at that point was, you know, disapproval because it was so blatant, but then quick forgiveness when, you know, he apologized or kind of explained away. That was the initial arc that I was anticipating.
Because
there's quick forgiveness to be had for men who cross the line here or there. Now, again, I will say that this is not startling if you have followed Falwell Jr. over the recent years. If you have followed his Instagram feed, he posted a lot. I mean, I have been, and it's hard to know what to do with this stuff. It's not, you know, not crossing the line maybe, but walking that line, certainly
right
in terms of what's appropriate for a leader of a Christian university, a leader of frankly any university. It's just weird stuff, you know, his pelvic thrust weightlifting videos, his, I think there's one with him holding cheerleaders on his shoulders. Like this kind of physical contact that would make me as a university employee very uncomfortable and probably, you know, at least suggest that some sort of Title IX investigation might be appropriate. Just really, again, if not crossing lines, then there were plenty of red flags.
Absolutely. A lot of shirtless photos of him at the lake on the jet ski and
on the horse.
Yeah, it reminds me of the sort of the Vladimir Putin sort of thing. Absolutely. The shirtless Putin on a horse crossing a lake. You know, this muscular macho guy working out, he's tough, he's in good shape, he's not, you know, ashamed to admit. But then there's pictures of him on a holiday in Greece with, you know, bikini clad women. Who are these people? What is he doing? It's bizarre.
It's very strange.
Yeah, that the Instagram thing is what finally took him down. But even then, he wasn't fired.
No.
He wasn't sacked. He was given a reprieve. Well, nothing. There was silence, as you say, crickets from the Liberty board. Nothing. Yeah. Then he resigns, takes it back, goes and resigns again. And then we find out he's got this incredible deal. But what's weird about the story, now the Becky Falwell connection. Okay, so we got to go into that. She gets thrown under the bus, as I see it, because he tried to get out in front of the story with this sort of apologetic, very Christian-y sounding letter or response to it, saying, look, she had the affair. I had nothing to do with it. But of course, Granda alleges that there was a sexual affair and he liked to watch them having sex. Now, that's a completely different narrative than, well, she was having an affair and I had nothing to do with it. That's two totally different storylines.
Exactly. So with his initial, what was it, Sunday night letter, Falwell's, you know, trying to get out in front of the Reuters story. Mm-hmm. I remember tweeting when that came out, like, this makes sense of some of the pieces, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. And again, we had a lot of these pieces already in place last summer with the New York Times story. And at that point, it really seemed like the likeliest way to make sense of the pieces that we had was, you know, we're talking some sort of threesome here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, exactly what that looked like, hard to tell. But that was definitely where the evidence was pointing as far as I could interpret it. But again, you know, allegations, inferences, but that's what we seem to be looking at. So yes, a number of people noticed his wording in that statement, which is not the usual kind of wording. You know, my wife had an affair in which I was not involved.
Strange way to word it.
If Granda had stayed quiet, he would have had a very, very quick and easy path to redemption. He would have been the faithful husband. And, you know, even if it seemed to some like his masculinity had been, you know, sullied in some way, I think that enough of his supporters would have recast him as this noble, heroic figure who could take back his wife. And, you know, we just continue on from there. Mm-hmm. That's not the story that came out the next day. Mm-hmm. That's not Granda's version of events, which given the evidence that is accumulating does seem fairly believable, even as Falwell continues to deny that. But as that story came out, there's been so many, right? My first question was really, what is Becky's agency in this? And particularly for an affair that lasted 7 years, I really was struggling to understand her role in this. And then, of course, we have the very recent allegation of a former Liberty student who is accusing her of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. That story, together with Granda's version, makes sense. Again, that we've got allegations, we've got, you know, people are disputing. This is all very much kind of still being sifted out. But that's a whole other kind of layer to this that needs to be better understood, and then understood in terms of evangelical culture and evangelical ideals of sexuality. And this is going to be kind of pushing those to their limits. Because on the one hand, within evangelicalism, we do have this strong emphasis on a wife's requirement to please her husband sexually. Mm-hmm. And so to be sexy, to be sexually objectified, all of that, but it's absolutely supposed to stay within patriarchal heterosexual marriage. Mm-hmm. We have a whole other wrinkle here, right? So I guess I could imagine if you know, And we have to talk about perhaps Falwell Jr.'s sexuality as well. Mm. And again, looking to his Instagram, there are many photos of him with young women. And then there are many of him with young men as well in kind of awkward positions or kind of situations.
Inappropriate at best.
Shirtless
cringy, men. Cringy. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff.
Or college president. Yeah.
Exactly. Because there's that other piece. I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm certain, I feel like, this could be a hazarding a guess here, but the Benjamin Crosswhite story, again, like the Gronda thing, loaning him all this money to buy a hostel seems a pool boy that you just met at a Miami hotel. You just loaned him millions of dollars. Then you got this Crosswhite. They basically give him an 18-acre facility. The school gave it to him and then leased back the tennis courts at $650,000 a year when he didn't actually own it. And yet somehow he ends up with this unbelievable deal that Falwell pushed through. And there's all these pictures, like you say, of him and Falwell shirtless by the lake, muscles out and the whole thing. You think, what is going on? It can't be a normal, just a real estate deal helping a friend.
No.
So I'm waiting for something to come out there. Surely the whole thing is so bizarre.
So what are we looking at? We really don't know yet. And you know, this is not your standard patriarchal heterosexual marriage.
Right.
Was it was it still patriarchal kind of open marriage? I don't know. Was this what was Becky's role here? What was their relationship? I have no idea. Maybe people closer to them can speak into this, but at this point we have so many questions. That's the Falwell situation, right? It seems somewhat unique. I'll go out on a limb and suggest this. But then again, we have this question of the community locally and then, you know, more broadly, evangelical community, who was okay with this, who allowed this to get to this point, who either condoned this or facilitated this or ignored this for so many years. Mm-hmm. And again, to just return to what was it about evangelicals that, they would allow this to continue and really to fester and to reach this rather dramatic point.
Yeah, they've enabled it really for years. The Board of Liberty. I mean, I'm interested to look at this whole thing as like a case study. I mean, we're talking real people's lives. I mean, it's not just an abstract case study, but one of the things that I find interesting about it is, and I think you talk about this in your book, you see this unfolding over and over again. When a woman gets sexually assaulted in an evangelical church setting, there's often this narrative whereby she'll be shunned and silenced and encouraged not to speak out. If her assaulter is even a pastor or a church leader, the whole thing will be hushed up or ignored, or he'll be quickly restored, as you say, and then everything will be just kind of swept under the rug. Yeah. The woman gets really screwed over and thrown under the bus. But in this case with Becky Falwell, it's the opposite. I'm really curious to find out what they do, if anything, to her, because some of this involves a legal aspect. I read in an article today, because she was technically an employee of Liberty at the time of this alleged sexual assault of this friend of her son's who was playing in a band with her son. I was thinking about this. I was telling my wife today, if I did that to one of my daughter's friends, jumped in bed with her, pulled her pants down, and so I'd be going to jail.
But so I think there has to be legal.
There's a legal aspect of it. You could say, well, guys would look at it and say, hey, man, that's every man's fantasy. A woman crawls in bed and gives you oral sex. Happy days. But it's a sexual assault.
It is sexual assault. At an educational, it's sexual assault, whether, if she's a woman or, if the predator is a man, it is absolutely sexual assault. And it's sexual assault that happens in a university setting. And so it's going to fall under Title IX. And so Title IX is going to require investigations. And I'm not quite sure if there are any differences in how some of these rules will apply to a private institution like Liberty. I'm not quite sure what that, I teach at a private Christian university and we are still fully under the Title IX requirements, but it would require an investigation and severe consequences for the university for failing to follow up on this, certainly if they were ignoring evidence that was there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you have to go, you're super busy, but I have one last question for you. I was reading an article today and it was basically asking the question rhetorically, will this affect evangelical support for Trump? One of his main supporters has just gone down in flames. And will this affect the Trump vote in 2020? And one of the quotes in the article was from Sarah Posner, who Sarah, She was on the podcast not long ago talking about her book Unholy. And she made the statement that it won't matter at all. That base is going nowhere. It's just going to be a blip on the radar screen. Nothing's going to change. Do you agree with Sarah Posner on that?
Yeah, Trump's evangelical base is not going anywhere. But what we're really looking at in this election is, you know, single digit percent. So any true believer is not going anywhere. And it may well be that we have, in fact, I would wager we do have more true believers within the evangelical community in 2020 than we had in 2016 when it comes to Trump. What we're looking at is maybe 3-4 percentage points. If there are any evangelicals, and there are some, there are many who are deeply concerned about Trump and, you know, the evangelical witness. Now, my sense is still that the vast majority of those who are very uncomfortable are not those who voted for him in 2016. But I think what Democratic activists are really trying to look for are, you know, the small number of people who may have given him a try, who did not then become his loyal supporters. And what you really need is, again, you know, 3-5% in key battleground states, and that can make the difference. So yes, I would be shocked if we saw a mass exodus of evangelical support for Trump on November 3, but, you know, again, we need a sliver.
I think you're right. I agree with that. And kind of going along with that, there's been a couple of articles, I don't know if you've seen them, that have come out saying, will this cause Christians, like students at Liberty, to question their Christian faith? Will they deconstruct and walk away from Christianity altogether over this whole thing? And the consensus on that seems to be, yeah, maybe a few, but generally speaking, no, it's not going to cause anybody to leave the faith and deconstruct. So, you know, who knows? I'm interested to see how this whole thing plays out. But thank you so much for taking the time out. I know you've got a super busy schedule, but I mean, this is a fascinating story and it's going to be unfolding even more. So thanks, Kristen, for taking some time out of your day, and I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.